we've had assumptions about food security. Some of those assumptions have not always been true. So like in the 1960s, there was a lot of international in-kind food aid. You come in with boats of food when, in fact, what's really needed is a cash transfer would probably have been the best thing to do. This is where it matters. So if you do your analysis well, you're able to zoom in on those factors so that the best decisions are made.
My guest today is Jean-Martin Bauer. At the time of recording, he was the newly appointed country director in Haiti for the World Food Program. To put it simply, his job is to make sure people don't run out of food. And for a country like Haiti, that's no simple feat. I wanted to talk to Jean-Martin Bauer, who's been working at the World Food Program for many years now, about his experience working with data and how that's helped on very pragmatic tasks like feeding people. Previously, Jean-Martin was a senior digital advisor, again at the World Food Program, where his job was to advocate for the use of data and how that can help their tasks. So now, in his current role as country director, I wanted to understand how they use data, and more specifically satellite images and maps, in order to help feed people. Before we get started, I wanted to say a thank you to Element 84, who's been kind enough to sponsor this podcast for a little while, and to thank them for their support. Element 84 is a geospatial software engineering company, and they focus on big Earth data problems. One of the examples of the things they've done is they've taken the Sentinel-2 optical imagery and put it on AWS to make it a lot easier to find. I've actually had Dan Pallon, their CEO and co-founder, on the podcast on episode 16, so you can head to the show notes to find that episode and hear more about Element 84. With all of that said, here's my conversation with Jean-Martin Bauer. So, hi Jean-Martin. I'm really excited to have you on the podcast. I'm quite excited to talk with you. I don't know if you know, but I like starting these conversations with the same question to my guest every single time. I like asking people how they would describe themselves. And so I'm quite curious to know, how would you describe yourself?
Thanks, Max. Thanks for having me on. It's nice to be here. I describe myself as a geographer masquerading as a humanitarian. So I'm happy to be on Missing Maps. I got trained in geography as an undergrad, and human geography, not physical geography. I was interested in places and people and relationships between themselves and how that shapes the societies we live in. It's probably what drew me to the work I'm doing right now with the World Food Program in Haiti. So if you want to know who I am, probably geographer first. What I tell people is when I retire from my job here, my business would probably say Jean-Martin Bauer, geographer. So.
What is humanitarian geography? You said it's focused on human geography. Like what is that?
Well, human geography is as opposed to physical geography, which is the landscape, the soil, the flows, the atmosphere, and human geography is about how a place determines or influences or affects society in terms of the way society function, how economies, communities, businesses, individuals, how all that is mediated through space. And I find that quite interesting because I also did a lot of economics, and I think economics on its own doesn't tell the entire story. I'm calling you today from Port-au-Prince, for instance, where place and where you are in clusters of people who are alike or different explains a lot, or is also an indicator of how society works. Right here, you've got a city that's right by the sea that goes from sea level to almost 1 mile high, so 1,600 meters and maybe 20 kilometers. So it's very steep. If you want to understand how poverty and inequalities turn into humanitarian issues in this country, you have to understand the geographies of the poverty, the geographies of access to resources, the geographies of inequality. And an economist, I think, would find a good friend in a geographer. And I think if you bring both of those disciplines together, you You begin to disaggregate and illuminate things in a way you wouldn't be able to if they were working in silos. So that's what I think the power of geography brings. And human geography is about how human beings' lives day to day and the structures and patterns of the societies they live in is influenced by space and place.
Do you have like examples of that? I think to a lot of people it makes sense, but I'd still be curious to know if you have any examples where you've seen that.
Let me give you an example, Max. So until a month ago, I lived in New York. New York's a city with millions of people. It's gigantic, one of the top cities in the world. Great place to be. But if you dig down into what New York is like, you realize that each part of Manhattan's a little bit different. The thing that tourists say is that, or that tourists are told, is that New York is in fact 200 villages, and not just not more than a big city. But I lived in Midtown East, and not far from the UN, which is a very specific neighborhood, and that's where you will walk into a bar and meet other UN people you haven't seen in meetings, and there's this sort of magic that operates because you meet people with the same mindset, some similar opinions, and this in fact, the people and the institutions based in that part of New York feed off each other. So if it's the UN, the universities, the hospitals, the restaurants, and they actually create a fairly cohesive community. That's my experience in Manhattan, that space and being in the same area actually influences how business is done and how a social system operates. But the same is true with Silicon Valley. I mean, why do you have this big cluster of companies that work on technology in the same place? Because there's a huge benefit to being co-located into being not too far one from the other, because you get multipliers, you get the positive effects, you get synergies, and that's something that space brings. It's something that proximity brings that you wouldn't really get otherwise. Now, of course, we've been talking a lot about how the pandemic has changed the way we work, with more remote work, with people not necessarily being in the office as much. So this is probably going to change in some way. But the reality is that people do seek out spaces. People who are creative quite often seek out the same neighborhoods, the same parts of town. You can think of Soho in London, or you could think of areas like that. And that's really why human spaces matter in our lives. But then there's also a flip side to that. You've got also geographies of inequality, and There are very different ways of talking about those, but I'm up here in the hills above Port-au-Prince, and down there you've got neighborhoods that are controlled by gangs, where you've got malnutrition affecting 1 out of 5 children, and again they're clustered in specific spaces. I don't want to make it sound like people are determined to food insecurity and malnutrition if you live in one of those neighborhoods. People do have agency. But it is it's an interesting lens to analyze the society we live in to see these patterns, these clusters, because they make you ask more questions and they challenge your assumptions about the type of work we do.
I guess I was actually expecting you to go on a completely different scale and be like, well, if you're based in an area with very fertile ground, like that's where agriculture is going to be less of a problem than somewhere else. And like, I was kind of expecting that sort of answer, and where the geography of the place where you are, if you have access to the sea and there's a lot of fish, you know, that's a place where food might be less of a problem, something like that. But what you're telling me is that It's also about who the other people are around you that have a determining role in what happens to yourself as an individual as well.
Well, yeah, Max, I'm not that much of a believer in the determinist. If you've got land, you're not hungry. I think it's food security is much more complicated than that, and it is about the social relationships, the social capital. I don't want to go back to trite stereotypes, but you do have in the world very arid areas that are quite food secure, and then places where I've lived in Central Africa that are as green and well watered and sunny as you want, but with huge food insecurity issues. So it does come down to the people and the relationships between them. Hunger in our day and age, it's about conflict. It's about social inequalities. I of course, you where you've got conflict and social inequalities in a context where the land is extremely poor and the weather's bad, that's where you get the worst outcomes. But I tend to start with social relationships, social inequalities, the socially mediated access to resources. That's what matters.
So let's get a little bit into your new role right now. You work at the World Food Program. Can you explain a little bit what your current role is right now? Because I think it's quite interesting to go a little bit on that.
So my current role, I'm WFP's country director in Haiti. I arrived here almost a month ago, not quite. So I'm still very new to the role. Actually, I haven't been to Haiti in 25 years. So for me, I'm adjusting my assumptions about this place. It's what I've been doing over the past few weeks. It's a country that's suffered a lot. And I think what really shocked me was when I came here on May 23rd, and I was shocked to see from the plane how the landscape's been scarred by decades of deforestation. I'd come in Haiti in 1997 and 1998, for a few months each time, and back then deforestation was a huge issue. And what I'm seeing now is that everything that people were fearing in the 1990s has come to life. You've got rivers that have turned into huge gullies with carrying sand into the plains and into the sea. There's been a huge loss of cropland and huge erosion and. To me, it really looks like we're creating a new version of the Sahel here in the Caribbean. So that to me was especially shocking. So I'm trying to understand these different things. Of course, one of the major challenges for food security in Haiti right now is the fact that there is there are between 150 and 200 gangs in Port-au-Prince, there's a lot of insecurity and that's affecting people, and I need to I'm trying to understand exactly how that all works so that WFP's programs here do the right thing for the people who are most vulnerable in this country. Now, what I did before was different. I was with WFP in New York, as I said a little earlier, and what I did there was I was working on digital. I was advising WFP on I'd say on digital writ large, but what I was busy with day to day was looking at how the UN is changing the way it works in a day and an age where technology and digital technology is changing everything around us. The Secretary General of the UN adopted something he called the Roadmap for Digital Cooperation in 2020, and that sets out in broad brushstrokes what the UN should be doing to make the world a better place by leveraging digital tech. And it talks about universal connectivity. That roadmap also talks about things like open source and digital public goods. It's a very ambitious roadmap. It's got a lot about protection, about making sure people aren't left behind, that human rights are respected online as they are offline. So all of this is means that the agencies that are part of the UN need to sit down and think about how the work they're doing is being transformed by the new digital world we live in. So, I mean, I'm saying new, it's been around for decades now, but what's changing now is that there's a political push to do this better, to do this responsibly, and to think strategically about these impacts. So that was my job in New York, was to make sure WFP engaged in these discussions, and that we also contributed and shared what we had to show with them. So we are an operational agency. We have areas of excellence in terms of use of big data. We've also been one of the big agencies that's taken on digital cash transfers. We've done more than $2 billion a year of cash transfers, most of which is digitally enabled. So we don't do cash in envelopes that much anymore. The beneficiaries usually have some form of a payment card or a mobile money account. And these are the platforms that he uses to push out payments. And therefore, sharing that experience on the New York scene was also something I was doing. And of course, there was the usual networking with other partners in New York. And if it's the universities in New York, the NGOs that are there, again, it's the type of city where you meet people with similar interests, no matter how niche they might be. And that's that's what I was up to there. So had an advisory role in New York, and here I've an operational role. But this is more or less how I've done my career. I mean, I started working in West Africa for WFP 20 years ago. I did a few operational posts, moved to the regional bureau in Dakar, where I did the market analysis for a few years, then moved to the headquarters of WFP in Rome. And that's where I started working on automated data collection, automated surveys in different parts of the world. This was in 2012. We were sort of blazing the trail on acquiring data from difficult places using things like IVR, SMS, and then other mechanisms. After that, WP thought, hey, Jean-Martin should go back to operations. And I spent a few years in Congo as WP's representative in Brazzaville. After that, New York, and then here. So I like to think I bring both the operational perspective, but also a knowledge of how data can help humanitarians do their job better.
Yeah, that's something I'd like to get a little bit more into, especially since you seem to have had like multiple roles at different angles on that. Like I'm sure that the work that you're doing is probably going to leverage some of the digital work that you've done before. On one of the things I was curious, for example, is how do you know the food situation in a country? I was looking at there's a hunger map that's done by WFP, and
that's
I was
right.
Looking at Haiti just before the recording, and you go on there and it's like red. It's most of the country, there's food insecurity, and the question that pops to my mind is, how do we know that? How do you assess the situation?
To be honest, you don't need the hunger map to tell you that there's a problem in Haiti. It's well known, but the hunger map helps you be a little bit more deliberate with the questions you ask. And food insecurity is a very abstract term, and it's made up of different components. And I think we've had assumptions about food security historically. This is, when I say we, this is the food security community. And I think some of those assumptions have not always been true. So we assume that things about food production, for example, that lack of food production equals food insecurity, which isn't the case. We've made mistakes in the past in terms of what type of response option is appropriate for specific context.
Could you expand on that a little bit?
Well, look, and this is in the 1960s. There was a lot of international in-kind food aid. You come in with boats of food when, in fact, what's really needed is a cash transfer would probably have been the best thing to do. And but again, I mean, an agency like WFP is able to do both and does analyze things quite thoroughly. And in fact, Max, this is. Where it matters. So if you do your analysis well, you're able to zoom in on those factors so that the best decisions are made. I think what's not, it is interesting to know whether a country's in trouble or not, and you know where they are on that scale. You know, is it a yellow, an orange, or a red, or you know, for specific areas, is it a yellow, an orange, or a red, or even a green? But it's also why. I mean, what's going on? Is it because of conflict? What's the role of climate in it? How are the markets doing? That's what's really interesting about food security analysis, is that these factors keep changing. I mean, I've been amazed in my career as a food security analyst to see that sometimes things just flip on a dime. I mean, in just a few weeks, the situation totally changes. I think you had that with the war in Ukraine. I mean, the situation was not very good. The global food security situation wasn't very good with high food prices and food inflation already in early 22. But as soon as that war started, we faced a very new and painful reality worldwide. So food security analysis also has to be flexible enough to capture these dynamic events. A country like Haiti, for instance, relies on imports for 80% of the rice that's consumed. I think the majority of food that's eaten in Haiti is actually imported by value. And something like the war in Ukraine is a huge risk for countries with an import with dependency on imports. So, and that's also true if you look at the country itself and you know what's going on in the north and the south of the different different parts of the country. They all have a specific profile, and you need to get acquainted with those. With food security, as in very many other areas of humanitarian practice, one size does not fit all. You need to be able to get acquainted with the communities and the different contexts in which an agency might operate to get things right. Might be okay to have more of a macro approach in a fast-breaking emergency, but to really get things right, you need the data, you need to understand the problem, you need to disaggregate it, and hopefully the agency and its partners are flexible enough to have the response that's just right for that environment.
Can we dive into a little bit deeper on how you get that data and how you analyze it?
So there's a lot of data that's available now. I mean, we've got a lot more data now than we did, say, 2 decades ago. When I started in the Sahel in West Africa, I think we'd get if we were lucky, we would get a weekly bulletin on rainfall and then another weekly bulletin with food prices. And if you were smart, I mean, you'd string these together for a few years and try to understand whether you were in a situation that was normal or anomalous. And that was helpful. I mean, don't get me wrong, that was helpful. But what I think what we need is something that's more detailed in order to drive decision making and allocations of resources and programs. So what I've seen in the past 2 decades is a much increased availability of data of all types in the countries we work in. That means we get the satellite data almost in real time. You get weather forecasts that are much more detailed. And we also have information on households. Again, when I started out, we would do these large household surveys, roving teams of specially trained enumerators would go out with, either paper or tablets. I mean, they'd go out and collect, thousands of questionnaires, and that would be brought back to the capital, and a report would come out like 9 months after you made the decision to do a survey, sometimes more. And I mean, again, the data is useful, but it's not dynamic, and food security is quintessentially dynamic.
People can't wait 9 months to eat.
No, you can't. So what you need is, of course, you do need that baseline knowledge of food security, but the dynamic aspect of it is essential. So what's also changed is it's not just that there's more data there, is that, for instance, what my colleagues did in Rome, Jonathan Rivers and his team in Rome, has been to use machine learning to predict food insecurity on the basis of indicators that are updated very regularly. So usually when I talk about food security, it's something that's measured at the household level. It's how many people in area X are not eating a sufficient diet. I mean, that's usually how we would want to define food insecurity. That's actually something that requires a lot of data acquisition. You can lessen that burden by doing things like doing a remote survey, or what we've been doing more recently is predicting that. So what Jonathan and his team have been doing is looking at rainfall, looking at food prices, looking at vegetation indices, looking at night lights, and predicting household level food insecurity thanks to machine learning. And this is actually quite accurate. It's been peer reviewed, and what this means is that we're now able to have a pretty good idea of what food security is like in a specific community, thanks to these mechanisms. So they lessen the data collection burden. You get your data quickly, and you're therefore able to work in a way that's more flexible. Now, of course, I don't want to make it sound like it's a panacea. I want to be really honest that these are new tools. They're very difficult for people who are not sort of in the club to understand. And there's a lot of work to do within the humanitarian space, with governments, with communities, so that these tools are understood. There are really good examples of how these tools have helped WFP adjust responses. In the case of Yemen, the example I've heard is that we were able to detect with the hunger map live a deterioration of food insecurity in a part of Yemen. I think in Yemen, they bring in conflict data as well. So the conflict data is also used as a factor in the estimate of food insecurity. And what the WFP office in Yemen was able to do was to increase coverage, so more people in that area got food, but also for longer. So they increased the rations. And that means that more people got more food as a result of a machine learning product. And I think that's really interesting for us. But before you get there, and I think that's the exception, we do have a lot of socialization, other methodology to do. We need to build capacities all over the humanitarian community, within the UN, the NGOs, with the governments we work with, especially the civil protection bodies that exist, the bodies that do early warning, so that we get to something that's better. There's actually quite a big gap between, I'd say, the discussions I heard in New York or that I heard in Rome and the reality and the practice in a place like Haiti or in a place like Congo. Yeah.
What can you go into some examples of, like, what might be some of those differences? Because also what I'm understanding is that what you're saying is these models they seem to use a lot of remote sensing or quite global data sets that help get a very global coverage. But I'm guessing very on a much more local scale, the discrepancy must change quite a lot. And so how do you deal with that? And what are the differences between, you know, a team in Rome and then using that on the ground in Haiti?
Well, I think the issue is, again, one size does not fit all, and each country is just very different. And having a global map is great. It's a great tool. But then the next step is actually having a local version of that. My colleagues who work in the same department at WFP Rome created a tool they called Prism. It's a front end that combines climate data from different sources, from different meteorology departments. It's a very interesting tool, but what they did, they didn't create a global climate dashboard. They customized it for different countries. They started doing that in Sri Lanka, and they've also had other implementations of it. And I think where you get value in those tools is when you actually sit down with the national authorities and the partners and figure out what's needed in that context. So in addition to these global dashboards, you know, maybe you do need those at a global level for advocacy, for media, for strategy. Well, you're going to need highly customized, versions of those tools, in the countries we work in, that are, customized with the people making the decisions, within the sort of the very intricate, web of relationships that exist in these countries. I remember in Congo, we worked with Cloud to Street on a on a flood mapping of Congo. And what we realized was that what we designed as a the flood dashboard wasn't exactly what people needed in Congo. We realized that we were facing 17 different agencies. And, you know, Congo is not a big country. I'm talking about the Republic of Congo, by the way. I use Congo as shorthand, but this is the right bank of the Congo. It's a country of about 5 million people, size of Montana, Congo and Ubangi River. So flood risk is a big deal over there. It's also a middle-income country with some resources, but when there's a flood in that country, it is 17 agencies, 17 government agencies that are responsible for the response. And then you've got the UN agencies and the NGOs helping out. There's no way you're going to design from outside a tool that's going to be useful for Congo. You need to sit down with them and see who they are, what the relationships are like. I don't even think I could give you all 17, but you had the MID agency, which was under the... I think that was under the Ministry of Interior. There was like aviation was also there. Social affairs, And the fire service was involved, the police, the Army, Ministry of Defense was involved. So they just had a huge set of stakeholders. And I think what ended up working for us in Congo was actually delivering the product in a way that was useful to the folks who were furthest on the front line. And it ended up looking like a maps that could be shared by WhatsApp, because everyone was on WhatsApp in Congo. So they would get sort of very local or relevant maps. Because I think the first step we had was we create this dashboard, and, you know, people could zoom in and scroll and toggle different fields. And, you know, no one was visiting that. I mean, maybe it was us in the WFP office, but we actually got a lot more visits when we started pushing it out by WhatsApp in a way that was much more user friendly and more adapted to the way people do business day to day in Congo. So a big part of the journey, I mean, this is a long way to say that a big part of the journey is just understanding the context you're in and not making the assumption that your brilliant global product is going to be the right solution in countries as complex as the ones we work in.
And it sounds like there's a whole other step. It's not just about like making that map or that data set, but distributing it and putting it in the hands of the people who can actually do something with it.
Right. And that's just so far from obvious. I think this is an area where we would find a lot of value by putting information in the hands of those who need them. I realize that, I mean, there's been some really interesting work in South Africa on community early warning systems. I actually met someone from South Africa who was showing me how a flood, a community that lived with considerable flood risk would exchange information informally and therefore better manage their flood risk that way. So there's what we're doing as institutions that's formal, institutional, top-down, and then you've got those bottom-up initiatives that I found really interesting, and I'd love to see a handshake between formal and informal early warning systems and see how those can, again, help us get better information and help the right people when needed.
So not just, so like get the people involved as well in bringing their knowledge and helping out with that. Is that
right? And in principle, technology is there to help us do that. So now that, well, I mean, South Africa, again, is a very, very specific place. But if people have a cell phone and a data plan, and there's just so much you can do to ensure that data is shared in some way. I mean, you have to share it in way that's responsible and useful, but I definitely see a lot of potential in making sure that we're first of all asking the right questions, that we understand what the issues might be, and that we involve people who are affected by these hazards and these risks, and involve them in the whole planning. I mean, I just told you about the 17 government departments in Congo, but I didn't tell you how we would do community outreach in Congo, because it's actually quite complicated to do there. But there definitely seems to be a strand of work that we can't ignore, which is how do you bring information from communities themselves to the table?
Could you expand a little bit on that, maybe quickly, like how you approach that?
Well, I think you would need a perspective and context whenever you've got a food crisis. And I always get a lot personally when I speak to the old timers in the communities. They will tell you this is the worst the worst flood since 1960, and you know, these are things you can kind of it helps you understand what's going on, and they also tell you how they're managing, how they're coping, what they need, and I think the problem that comes up time and again is that, I mean, we will, as humanitarians, set up an assistance program. We've got a complaints and feedback mechanism. But what you'd want to do is also engage with the communities as early as you can before there's a humanitarian need that arises. So being able to have some type of relationship with either community representatives, local NGOs, or other local interests. That always helps you ask the right questions, understand what's going on. I mean, mostly when something when a disaster happens, and maybe this isn't the case of like a massive like hurricane or for flood type of disaster, but it's always, you know, the local churches or locals will reach out and say, there's a problem here, please come investigate, you know, and then we will go out with our very standard disaster tools. But I'm what I would hope to see is a way, is a world where we're able to have that exchange between formal and informal mechanisms in a way that reinforces each other in a way that's standing. Of course, the issue would be, how do you standardize information that comes from a local community in a place like Haiti or Congo or wherever. But I'd hope this is something or managers and or technologists and or sociologists will figure out.
I wanted to come back on the like online human right that you were talking about earlier. I think this is a concept that we don't hear about very much. At least I don't hear about it very much, where I think when you're a data scientist or you work with maps or a technologist, you get really excited about the getting more data, basically, because you see, oh, we can do all these really cool stuff and we can get all these new insights and all these stuff that we can do. But we sometimes forget these are real people behind it. It's data that means something. It represents something. Can you expand a little bit on some of the work maybe that's been done around online human rights and what that is, maybe where it came from as well?
Yeah, well, I think in the case of the United Nations, it comes from our mandate as an organization that's the custodian of the Human Rights Charter, and the UN is expected to be a leader in this space and a forum where these discussions can happen. And I've seen OHCHR, which is the Human Rights Office at the UN, do very important work in this space. It's not really my area of expertise. I think the way I've looked at it has really been through the lens of data responsibility. When you're a data person working with the UN, in contexts like the conflicts or the emergencies we've experienced over the past decades, you're very quickly brought to the realization that data protection and data responsibility is an essential feature of any information system we set up, because you as an analyst, you will start seeing in your data things that go beyond food security analysis. We'll see that you understand the drivers of the conflict, understand a lot more about the conflict. And let's say you're just running a very simple food security questionnaire. You soon realize that the data you capture could be used or misused. Right. That means that as an analyst, you have a huge responsibility. And the call about what data to collect, how to process, how to store, how to manage data shouldn't be up to the individual. And when I was working with the World Food Program's headquarters in Rome, and when we started doing automated surveys, very quickly we started working with with HHI and Signal program at Harvard to work on principles of ethical data collection. We started engaging with the Leiden University Center for Innovation on responsible data practice. We began engaging with the OCHA, Center for Humanitarian Data. And I think that those partners helped us ensure we were at least asking the right questions before we started to collect data. And I think it led to a professionalization of what we were doing. And it's the journey we had in the team I just mentioned is something that's taking place at a much broader scale in the humanitarian community. At WFP, we were pleased to have hired one of the first data protection officers in the UN. Not the first, but one of the first. Her name is Carmen. Carmen Casado works in at HQ in Rome. And she's got the authority within WFP to guide the agency on data protection issues. And that shows that agencies are now taking data protection and privacy extremely seriously, that the governance around data protection and privacy has taken a leap forward. It did take like the first, I think we had a few years where that all that was taking shape. But where we're at today, we've got the right people, the right governance mechanisms in place to make sure we're doing our job properly.
I'm quite curious. Like I work in the Earth observation field. One of the big trends we're seeing is the what's called new space, which is like a lot of private companies are emerging and they're able to create new data sets that we didn't have before. Like, are these data sets that you can that you are leveraging at WFP, where we have higher coverage, like more resolution, for example, be it in time or spatially? We were talking about weather forecasts before. There's like a big push for with new companies trying to provide better, more granular weather forecasts. But those are private companies that are selling the data compared to open programs like Landsat, like Copernicus. What's kind of the, are you seeing a change in that sense? And what is that, what does that look like?
Well, again, I've seen much more data become available and I've seen colleagues leverage to great effect the imagery that they get from Copernicus and Landsat. What I found quite useful has been the higher resolution of those data products, the fact that we're able to combine them with other data sets in a way that delivers insight more quickly at a scale that's much more localized. And that's, in theory and principle, it's quite quite useful for humanitarian responders. I think with the private companies, I'm not sure we're quite there yet. Cost is still a barrier. That data is still behind a paywall somewhere. I've seen some companies release and data on an ad hoc basis to some of their partners, which I understand, but what we really need is to get to a place where private data, which accounts for a large percentage of the overall data that's out there, we need access to that to do ML, to do machine learning. And if we don't have access to it, we'll get into trouble. What I'd like to see and this is more than just geospatial data, but it's I'd love to see an open AI movement take place where the data itself and libraries could be shared in a way that's totally open for humanitarian purposes. But this whole space has to be designed so that private companies don't lose their competitive advantage, and we really need them to be on board. My colleagues who work at the WFP Accelerator in Munich have been doing very interesting work with Google Research. They've set up a project. I'm forgetting its name right now. Oh, okay. So the project is called Sky, SKAI. What that project does is they use machine learning to essentially classify damage to buildings in disaster affected areas. So I imagine the explosion in Beirut. I think they tested out the system on that scenario. So you get the imagery, feed that into Sky, and Sky spits out a map that's basically 90% accurate with the buildings tagged in light, medium, or severe damage, if you see what I mean, Max. So
yeah.
That's something we were able to do with Google, and I think Google was actually trying to work with us to make that open source. These are the things we need to do. So that's one of the applications that needs to be done, but there are many others, and from these pilots and these these isolated projects, we do need to. What I'm hoping I'll see is a move towards a world where we're able to have an open AI for imagery for individual statistics. I mean, I'm not saying people's names or anything would be shared openly, but survey data definitely needs to be shared in a way that's that enables better use and the use of methodologies like machine learning. So that's, I think, where we need to be going. It's still early days.
How do you think we get there? What is in it for those private companies that?
Well, I think some private companies see the benefit of working in low resource settings. They always learn a lot from working with us. But I think those who really can help us are the universities. There's the work of Monica Lam at Stanford that I find a very, and I think has a lot of potential for humanitarians. So we need an institution like a university to work here, because I'm not sure a Google would work on an under-resourced language and what they call under-resourced languages in sub-Saharan Africa, for instance. But if you want to use machine learning, you're going to have to, someone has to do it. And I think a university is probably the right type of institution to do that with rigor. And with the public interest in mind, and to keep the knowledge in the public setting. And I would love to see UN agencies and humanitarian agencies work with partners like that to enable the change that we need to see in the open AI or open data space.
Yeah, I think the open AI name is already taken. I don't know if you're familiar.
It is, yeah.
they have a bit of a changing reputation, let's say, about their ethos and their work, where like holding things back under the assumption that it would not be beneficial to open up algorithms to the world. It would be more detrimental than beneficial. At least that's their mm-hmm. own argument. But what you're talking about is not that company. It's more like a movement of like open data, but for machine learning.
Right. So I'm not talking about OpenAI the company, but OpenAI which would be essentially a coalition of partners who work together to make data available. I mean, there's a big data access problem right now in the community. There are initiatives at the World Bank, at the UN, to access private data for humanitarian purposes. And I think data access is one of the major issues, but it's not all of the issue. You also have the, can we share models? Can we share libraries? Can we leverage what others have done in the AI space? If we're not able to do that, unfortunately, I suspect that we'll see much duplication of work. People might consider AI to be a black box. Just the way humanitarian coordination works. Just imagine showing up in a meeting in a country like Haiti, and Agency X walks in with a map and they said, we did this with artificial intelligence, and no one understands what it really means because they haven't had access to the algorithm. That's, you know, those are the risks you're facing. So having things open for scrutiny, auditable, that builds trust. And what you can't afford to jeopardize in setting was trust.
I heard you on an other podcast that you did. You were mentioning that, like, you were moving towards like a machine learning first world, where it started, where a lot of the first insights came from those models that you were talking about. Like, so how do you build that trust, where more and more it seems like WFP is moving in that direction about getting insights derived from algorithms? How do you build that trust with the people to be like, this is 90% accuracy, like, people are going to be like, great, what about the 10% that's left? How do you, like, you and I probably understand that, but people who aren't familiar might not. How do you go about building that trust?
Well, those are not easy conversations at all, and we shouldn't assume they would be. You're always facing a group of people who've been doing something in a way that's, you know, that's done the job, that hasn't, but it's done the job for a long time, but that could be improved. And part of the challenge is converting that constituency to doing things in a different way. So in the case of damage assessments, maybe damage assessments isn't a great example because you don't have people or damage assessors, but just think of household surveys. You do have an Institute of Statistics in every country, and you know, and they do surveys with international partners all the time, and they're used to having a huge survey book and being trained for a week before going out, and so that's an entire system and an entire way of doing things that's very entrenched. And if you're telling them, well, look, we're going to use machine learning and we'll look at high resolution satellite imagery to map out poverty, thank you very much, you know, that just disrupts something that's been going on for a long time. So for me, it's about engaging with, you know, not just the people who'd be disrupted, but engaging with everyone about the value proposition of the new system. Making sure you're not selling snake oil, because sometimes people will sell snake oil and you end up in a situation where you undermine trust and you haven't created trust in a new system. So you need to validate, to be rigorous, to have some humility about it all. So what seems to work for me is when you're able to publish the paper, if you work with a credible academic partner, with your local partner as well, that's where the mindsets start to shift. It's not as easy as parachuting into a country and saying, we've got a new way of doing things, it's cheaper, let's go. It's a much longer term process. And, but you know, things do change. I mean, just think about where we were 20 years ago with food security analysis, with much less data, with very different processes. These things can change, but we do need to invest in not just in the technology platform, but in the processes of introducing these things and making sure they're they fit in and that they do add value.
Yeah, I think in the tech sector, it feels like disruptive is a very good thing. Like, you want to disrupt everything, but you're saying, like, no, that's actually not a good thing to come in and just try and change everything. Like, that's what disruption is. It's like a big change all of a sudden. Like, that's not how you're going to get the adoption of whatever new thing you're trying to bring forward.
Yeah, you're not. And we do work with governments. We work with institutions that are very well established, and you can't disrupt them because they're our partners.
Right, yeah.
So it's about building something together that's better. The language of disruption isn't suited to these contexts for that reason, is that we're here to help them. We're not here to disrupt them.
I think it's an important thing to keep in mind. I'm saying that also for myself. I think sometimes it's very easy to get a little bit stuck in the code and the data and forget that this is at the service of people, not at the service of the thing itself. I wanted to move on a little bit. When we had one of our earlier chats, you mentioned one of the things you wanted to touch on was the financing of how we collect data and how you thought that might change a lot in the humanitarian world. I wanted to expand a little bit, know a little bit what you had in mind on that.
Well, here's the issue. And this is something that came into my mind when I was talking to some old timers, you know, like 15 years ago, and they were telling me that, things like WFP VAM and FuseNet. So these are like the big food security analysis projects in the world. But these things didn't exist until the 1980s when when there was structural adjustment, and in fact, there were large budget cuts in the in ministries of agriculture all over the world, and therefore we had a lot less data to go by. And this was an issue in the late 80s and 1990s, and therefore the international community needed to fill the gap by producing data of its own. And the way this usually happened is that you'd get a donor would fund an agency or an NGO to do a specific data project. So, you know, you'd have the Embassy of Belgium would fund a nutrition survey in Haiti, and you know, you'd get a report with a Belgian logo, and you know, the PDF would be online somewhere, and life went on. I'm not sure that this is going to be the way data is financed in the future. Because now, because of the fact that data is now considered to be ideally open, the data should be shared, the data systems should be interoperable. These are all things that are filtering down and percolating down from the Secretary General's data strategy. So if that's the case, if data on vulnerability and all sorts of data that the UN uses are meant to be open, that means that they might be funded differently. Not one-to-one, like I just described, like from donor to agency. And I think what we might see more of is the donors pooling their money into one pot, funding and funding data collection, and not necessarily funding a specific agency for data collection. And they would fund data collection with the understanding that the data would then be made public or would be made open for others to use. So you're going from a model that's essentially point to point, which was you know, donor pays for an agency that works for the government to produce one data point, to now a network of people paying for data, and but paying for open data. So it's a more networked way of financing data collection, and I think it is breaking down the it could potentially change the way we've financed data collection in the past.
What do you think is making that change? Is it that the fact that now there is this push for all of that to be open, whereas it was more of a case by case before?
Well, I think it's a lot of the donors who do pay for all this data, they've now built up their own analytical capacities quite a bit. And they have their own analytical cells in their capitals, and they want access to the data, and they want access to each other's data. And that means making data open has a lot of value to them, and that's changing the way this is being funded. Now, I'm not saying that we're going to see a wholesale change in the next 2 or 3 years, but I'm suspecting that this is something that's coming down the pike, and that one of the key assumptions we had about how you fund data in humanitarian circles is this is going to change because technology is enabling it. There's the demand for, well, the technology is enabling it. That's one. The demand on the donor side for data is increasing, and I think they want the data directly rather than having it through a filter, through an agency filter. And the capacities for data use within the agencies is also quite has become much larger. I mean, in Most UN agencies have data scientists working for them. They do work on data products. The level of quality of analysis, I've seen that increase over the past few years because you've got more savvy people in the right places. So, and I think this is a good thing, by the way. This means that we will get better data products overall. But it does mean that something we've been very used to is going to change.
What do you think is going to be the impact on, like, at the level of the WFP?
Well, for WFP, for us, if we get access to more data, it means that tools like the HungerMap 5 will be enhanced. We'll be able to not look at just hunger, but perhaps other factors, and better understand the world around us. I think all that is very, very positive overall. So now I think you also need to be very flexible. You need to be more outward looking than we might have been in the past. Because what now matters is your ability to network, your ability to bring things together. So I told you about this product Prism, so which is this climate data front end, and the value of that is that it does bring together data from disparate sources into one place where governments can use it. That's been declared a digital public good by the Secretariat of the Digital Public Goods Alliance. That's actually the UN plus led by UNICEF. You've got other agencies there as well. That means that data is now not just about the agency and, you know, maybe that ministry you're working with, but it's also about everyone else. So it's a lot more about coordination and working externally and out in a way that's outward looking and with much more awareness of the external context than ever before. So it's I think we've done a lot of very good things with data, by the way, over the past 20 years, and I've described some of them. But now we need to be good data citizens with all of our partners, and that's going to require, again, a change in probably in our architecture and the data governance rules that we have, and in generally our approach with other institutions.
What's like now recently you changed, like your position, your role has changed. I'm guessing now you have a bit more of a overarching role where the digital aspect, the data aspect is one component of the things that you have to take into consideration to be able to solve some of the food insecurity in Haiti. I'm quite curious as to what role does that play now in your current role?
So the data is critical here. I think one of the big exercises we use for planning in Haiti is the IPC. The IPC is Integrated Food Security Phase Classification. It's a traffic light system that assesses the severity of food insecurity at the subnational level in many countries in the world. It's something that it's a tool that's existed for I'd say maybe 15 years. It was piloted in Somalia and now implemented in countries in Africa, Latin America, Asia. It's the system that the international community uses to declare a famine, for example. There's a very clear protocol to declare famine. You've got thresholds. There's a committee that works at it, and it's brought a lot of rigor to the process. So here in Haiti, we don't have a famine. You've got five levels, and famine is level 5 in the system in the IPC. But here we've got 1 million people in level 4, according to the IPC. So that's an emergency. 1 million people living on the brink of famine, essentially. So the next step would be famine. Having that kind of data and having consensus around the data is extremely important. So this is a tool that the government leads with local partners, but WFP is there, FAO is there, UNICEF is there, the other important partners, national, international, are represented in this committee. And we do it twice a year. The next one's in September, I think. And we use this mechanism to bring all the data to the table and understand what the situation in Haiti is like. So the last IPC was done right after the earthquake we had here in August last year. It helped send a very strong signal to the donor community. So overall, I mean, I told you about the 1 million people living on the brink of famine, but you also have an additional 3 million that are in phase 3, which is crisis. So if you take crisis plus emergency, it's over 4 million people in Haiti who need humanitarian aid. And that was an extremely strong signal to the international community about needs in Haiti. So I like the fact that we have these data points that we share with other agencies, that there's consensus around these numbers. They're very, very useful. But then, as we said earlier on in the talk, Max, food insecurity is essentially dynamic. So we haven't done the IPC in a few months. And if we were to update it today, I'd say we probably have a different number today. I mean, down there, and I'm sort of pointing down at the city here, there's been gang violence. I mean, a month ago, you had almost 200 people were killed in clashes, and you had thousands of IDPs because of the fighting among gangs. And that wasn't captured in the IPC we did recently. I'm not even sure we'd be able to collect data in some of these neighborhoods just because it's too dangerous. And I wouldn't want to put my people at risk. I mean, is it worth sending someone to one of those neighborhoods if they could get either kidnapped or shot? It's not worth it. So that's how these new technologies could help us with assessing the extent of food security in Port-au-Prince. So I think, yeah, data has become more important in a context like Haiti. We might need to work on making it more and more dynamic. And again, sharing the data is also a huge issue here. If we're able to make sure that data flows between the government, the agencies, the local organizations, and that it's shared with civil society, I think we'd get to a place where you'd get a very productive debate around needs and humanitarian response in Haiti. That's what I'd like to see.
I'd like to take a step back from the data and focus on like the people a little bit, like, because we're talking numbers and like, you know, the data is basically like either an image or a spreadsheet, but that represents real people behind. I can also imagine, I don't even know if I can, but that there's probably some very hard decisions that need to be made that come from the insights that you gather about. We're talking about people who have insufficient food. Like, this is a very serious problem with very serious consequences.
Absolutely.
How do you even start to make those decisions, like more on a human level, about like reconnecting with the fact that these are real peoples whose lives are affected, where every percentage of accuracy that you can gain, it probably has a direct impact on people's livelihoods.
Look, all these exercises that involve data, humanitarian contexts, have that embedded in them, is that we are talking about people, and we're talking about people in desperate need. That means we need to get, that means we need to do the job right. We need to be able to be accurate. We need to be competent with the findings, or else, yeah, the result could be that people who need help don't get it, or that we allocate resources in the wrong way. So, We need to have a professional, a high standard for all these exercises. So, but at the same time, we need to realize that you can't get everything right. I think I've often seen that we go a little bit too far. I think we nitpick too much. If I can use that term, Max, I know it's not very diplomatic, yeah. But I have worked and managed a data team in a UN headquarters. And I think sometimes we nitpick too much. And quite often the big picture is enough to get an operation going. If you go from assessment to implementation, there's like a huge gap because you have a lot of processes that mediate it. And what you need is of course a strong assessment, but then you also need the people on the ground to be just as rigorous in order to get the desired outcome. So if you're an analyst, you're not God, but you're a professional, and you need to be professional in the work you do. You need to be able to turn around data quite quickly. And you're not working in a university if you're working in a humanitarian agency. I mean, we need to know, and 80% accuracy is fine. Because if you wait for 100% accuracy, the report never comes out, the assessment never comes out, the targeting's not done, people wait. And while people wait, they get creative and you get into other types of problems. So I think that's how I would see it, is I would tell a humanitarian analyst that, first of all, people don't care about p-values. If you're at WFP, people will never ask you for a p-value. They'll ask you for the map. They'll ask you for the story. And if you're able to get that right, that's most of the work. This is not a place for perfectionists, unfortunately. You can have perfectionists working in the agency, but I think they might get frustrated at some point. But if you're in an operational role, you need to be able to guide day-to-day decisions with the best information you happen to have. And then you also need to realize it's not all in your hands, because folks in the field, they know very well what they're doing. They're really good at targeting. They're good at working with the partners. And what you need to do is enable them with information so they do their job better.
I wanted to have this conversation because I talked with Beth Tellman from Cloud to Street, and she really recommended talking to you about like making sure we have a real impact on the humanitarian side. And I've seen you be a little bit critical on some of the things that the data science community is doing sometimes about, and you mentioned, you know, not selling snake oil and like wanting to have a real impact. What would you like to see happen in you know, the data science community? Also, because of the people listening, a lot of people here are people who work with data, are data scientists. What is the thing that you'd like to see more of or less of actually in the whole world of data science, where people aren't seeing the reality of what you might be seeing in Haiti right now, for example?
Well, I mean, I don't want to throw a brick into the data science pond here. I think you guys do a great job overall. But I'd say there's still a mismatch between what I see in the community in the U.S. and the needs here in a country like Haiti. It's just very different. I would hope data science companies in the U.S. could either find local partners in a place like Haiti or have a franchise here that really works with us long-term, not have people come in and out on flights, but people who really understand the context of this country. I'd love to see the data science community in the U.S. help build a data science community in Haiti, working with the universities here or the professional training institutes or with other capacities that might be present in Haiti, because the issues that this country has are not going to go away in a year or two, and this country needs data scientists and programmers. But I'm not sure that the model of that I've seen out there is exactly what we need. We need to have data science become an accessible discipline. Haitians need to be able to get trained as data scientists, and data science expertise needs to be accessible, not to like the big agency. I mean, we can pay for it for WP. We can pay for data science expertise if we need it. But what about the Haitian NGOs? What about the local institutions here? They have data. They're interested in leveraging their data, but they can't fly in someone from Miami and pay them $800 a day, right? So I think there's still a big gap, and I'm just hoping the field can be less the data science community could engage in a way that's more empowering for a country like Haiti, and in a way that leads to longer term skills being built here. That's definitely part of the answer. I think it is about becoming familiar with your context and trying to create opportunities and becoming part of the landscape as opposed to a visitor. So, but I mean, that said, I've seen some data science people be great listeners, and that's definitely the case with Beth and Bessie and the others who work at Cloud to Street. They really do take the time to listen to the people they work with, and so what I'm hoping to see is that people like them could show how it's done to others and demonstrate how data science can add value in a humanitarian context and again democratize data science and have that be available to all the institutions in Haiti, not just the ones with no million dollar budgets.
I think that's a nice place to start rounding off. I like asking people for book or podcast recommendations. There's a couple of reasons for that. I think it is quite telling about people, like if what they read or listen to. And then it's just that a lot of these are communicated through word of mouth still. So would you have any recommendations of things that you might have read or listened to recently that you think are of interest? And it doesn't have to be anything that we talked about right now, but just I mean by that, you know, fiction, for example, is a great recommendation. I don't know if anything comes to mind.
Well, I think for me, I'd like to encourage people to read The Masters of the Dew. In French, it's called Les Gouverneurs de la Rosée. It's actually an old book. It's written in 1944 by a guy called Jacques Poulmain. He's an author and politician in Haiti. He died when he was quite young. He died in his 30s. But wrote a book about Haiti, about rural Haiti and its struggles. It's an easy read. It's light. You can read it in a couple hours. If you read French, even if you're not that great in French, it's actually written in the present tense. It's an accessible book. But it is about inequalities, about hunger, about what holds a community back. I think it's also an inspiring story of hope. For those who are into novels, I'd recommend that one. As a food security person, I've been on. Let me see. I think a classic is Stuffed and Starved by Raj Patel. Again, that one's also a few years old. It's not recent, but it's I think it makes a good read about what's wrong with the global food system, and it's a good inspiration for those of us working to change it. So that's fiction and nonfiction, and in terms of podcasts. Let me see. I'd like to do a plug for the Humanitarian AI podcast. It's run by my friend Brent Phillips. Great guy. Good. He always seems to find guests who have something very specific to say, and I find those to be good listens. So check out the Humanitarian AI podcast if you can.
Yeah, I'll put all of that in the show notes as usual, and I think that's the one you've been on as well. I listened to your to you on that one in preparation of that. So yeah, I'll put all of that in the show notes.
Great.
Thank you very much for your time, Jean-Martin. This has been great, very insightful, and really appreciate you spending some of your valuable time with me.
You're welcome, Max. Anytime. Good luck with the podcast.
Thank you. Appreciate it. I hope you found this conversation with Jean-Martin Bauer interesting. Talking to people like Jean-Martin who are working directly in the field with the people and trying to help them, and how they use data and satellite imagery at the service of the population, is something that I want to explore more and more with this podcast. I myself work as a data scientist when I'm not working on the podcast. And sometimes it's easy to get lost in the code and the data and things like that. And I think it's really important to have conversations with people who are very grounded on what they're doing and are critical as well about these tools and how we can continuously make them better. Because at the end of the day, our job is really to help and empower the people on the ground. I always find like these conversations stay with me for a few days or a few weeks. And I like these because I see them as a bit of a reality check to making sure that what we're doing is still at the service of people. Anyway, if you've made it this far, I want to say thanks for listening. I thank my guests for spending some of their valuable time, but I want to thank you as well for spending some of your valuable time listening to these conversations with me. If you've enjoyed these so far, I'd like to ask if you can consider leaving a review on Apple Podcast or on Spotify if you're listening there, or put a comment on YouTube. Let me know what you think of those conversations or how they could be improved. By you providing feedback on the show, that helps me make it better, but it also signals to other people that this is a show worth listening to, that people find value and find it interesting. It also makes it easier for me to reach out to other guests, where I can point to some of the feedback that I've gotten and show that there's legitimate interest. It makes it easier sometimes to book some guests. You can also head to mindsbehindmaps.com, where you can find all the previous episodes as well as show notes. And you can find a form where you can send me some feedback if you have any suggestions for guests or any feedback on how to improve the show. Thanks again for listening, and I hope I'll catch you next time. Cheers.